For most of us, the history of the American newspaper starts with dim recollections from high school government class about how the American Revolution was fueled by circulation of some pamphlets like Thomas Paine's Common Sense. But the story of how newspapers in the United States evolved through the end of the 19th century is a rich one, filled with colorful characters and wonderful anecdotes. Author Alex Wright has documented this story in his new book, Empire of Ink: The Printers, Rogues, and Radicals Who Invented the American Newspaper. We are very lucky to be joined by him this morning. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Roger. Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
So let's talk about what motivated you to write this book and how long did it take to do the research?
Well, yeah, this book was a long time in the making. It really started for me with just kind of scratching an itch around my own family history. I come from a family of small town newspaper people going back to the 19th century. My ancestors ran little country newspapers in Georgia starting back in the 1880s, 1890s, the Liberty County Herald, and then the Ludowice News. And, you know, for about 100 years, they were running various like little itty bitty papers in different parts of Georgia. And I guess it must be genetic or something. It just got in my blood. I got the news bug. And, you know, my mom worked in papers for a while. One of my first jobs was like working at a TV news station in my hometown of Richmond, Virginia. And then I went through kind of a long, varied career path doing this, that, or the other thing, kind of in and out of the news business, working a little bit in the tech world. But I was always kind of curious about what that world was like. And what was interesting to me is even though my ancestors had spent almost between them like 100 years editing these little country weekly newspapers, nobody in the family had ever somehow managed to save a copy of any of these papers. So there was just all these like stories, but nobody really saw these and they hadn't been digitized. And so I just got kind of interested in, well, what was that world like? And originally, actually, this book started as a novel, kind of a half-baked novel about what, you know, kind of an imagined version of one of my ancestors working in a country newspaper. But the more I started researching it, I ended up just getting pulled down the rabbit hole of like 19th century newspapers. And it turned into something else altogether, which was this kind of journey through that world and just how it evolved. And it just turned out to be just a really interesting space to live in. But, you know, overall, I've been working this book in fits and starts for like 15 years or something. So.
And there are a lot of wonderful rabbit holes in the book. but let's before we get into some of the substance, let's sort of give people a big picture perspective. From the time of the revolution till, say, the end of the 19th century, what was the growth pattern like in the number of newspapers and the variety of newspapers we saw in this country?
Well, it was a period of explosive growth. And this really kind of shocked me when I really dug into it. At the end of the Revolutionary War, there were 37 newspapers being published in the former colonies. And by 1900, that number had risen to over 20,000. And at that point, those 20,000 newspapers represented more than half of the newspapers being published in the entire world for a country with less than 5% of the world's population. So what was going on there? Like, why were Americans so like kind of uniquely obsessed with the news? And that became kind of an animating question behind the whole thing. Like, you can't just, yes, there was new technology, presses got faster, there was industrialization, but that alone doesn't really explain it. Like, there was something about the demand for news and this kind of like uniquely American kind of mania for news that I think is still with us in some ways. So
newspapers become increasingly important in the run-up to the revolution. Let's talk a little bit about what they were doing and what role they played in the independence movement.
Well, yeah, so for the first, you know, almost 100 years of, you know, of colonial history, newspapers were for the most part kind of sanctioned by the government. Like the British Crown, you basically had to have a license from the Crown to print, and print the output of those printing, you know, those print shops was pretty closely monitored. You know, a lot of the early printers, you know, for many of them, newspapers were not their primary business. Mostly they were printing things like government contracts or, you know, various kinds of job printing. They weren't really publishing a lot. Interestingly, for the most part, American printers were not printing books. And this, I think, is actually part of the thread here, is that the nature of the American printing economy was sort of different from the start. It initially was kind of very closely tied to governments and businesses and doing that kind of commercial printing or government printing. And then many printers started like publishing these little weekly newspapers as kind of a side hustle. Like it was just an additional thing they started to do to make a little extra money. Probably the most successful of them was Benjamin Franklin, who became a real kind of early media mogul. Like he became a very successful printer, used his newspaper, the Pennsylvania Gazette, to promote his books like Poor Richard's Almanac and make a name for himself. But he was also, in a way, a kind of a mentor to a whole generation of printers. A lot of people came and apprenticed with him and learned the trade, you know, at his feet. And then they went on to start their own print shops and their own newspapers. And so over time, as the early colonial print economy started to grow, printers started to assert a little more independence. And they started to like take sort of editorial positions on government policy in a way that they were sort of starting to test the boundaries a little bit. And that all really came to a head in 1765 with the introduction of the Stamp Act, which I'm sure everybody remembers from their history classes. But I think what a lot of people don't really understand about the Stamp Act is it was a tax that was really directly targeted at printers first and foremost. And essentially, printers were going to have to pay a fee for every page that they printed. And it was became seen as sort of an existential threat to the printing industry. And in a lot of ways, I think you can argue, printers really played such a central role in fomenting the revolutionary movement because their livelihoods were at stake. And they really were self-interested in all of this. And so early on, you had printers like Franklin certainly came out opposed to the Stamp Act. There was a guy named William Bradford, who had published another paper in Pennsylvania, who famously designed his newspaper to look like a tombstone one day, that the tombstone edition. It had like kind of a gravestone at the top. It was kind of, it was probably the first sort of example of a designed newspaper front page. It was all, you know, basically an attempt to gain public attention to the cause of the Stamp Act. And he was basically claiming that this was going to put him out of business. It was going to be the death knell for newspapers and publishing. Of course, he then turned around and published his next edition the following week. So like newspaper publishers have been proclaiming their imminent death for hundreds of years.
There's a great picture of that in the book of the Tombstone Edition.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a fun little artifact. Yeah. But anyway, as the independence movement started to gather steam, you know, newspaper printers were instrumental in that. They really, you know, think about it, this is a far-flung group of colonies, mostly people living in rural settlements. You know, they're really kind of dependent on the nascent newspaper industry to get information about what's going on in the world. And not that all newspaper printers were revolutionary. Like there were many who supported the crown. Like there was active debate about all this. There were certainly like loyalist newspapers as well. The Patriot papers were really the ones that started to carry the day. So for example, like Thomas Paine's work, you know, found an audience through the pages of newspapers, which would freely reprint his essays. There was a famous series of essays called Letters from a Farmer that, you know, kind of went viral in a way. And people started to like, you know, the movement started to build largely in the pages of papers and the conversations that flowed out of that. And I think you can't reduce it down to a single cause and effect. Obviously, the papers, the printers and the publishers were picking up on conversations that were happening elsewhere as well, but they certainly amplified and sort of, provided a lot of fuel to the fire that ultimately led to the Declaration of Independence and so forth. So.
You know, your point about how there were then loyalist papers and sort of independent-minded papers. So the sort of notion of journalists as advocates or journalism or newspapers mm-hmm. as espousing particular points of view, which we complain about today, dates back to before the Revolution.
Oh, for sure. I mean, they were very opinionated. Like the whole modern ideal of journalism, this sort of neutral, just the facts, dispassionate kind of approach to news, is a relatively recent invention. Like, I think it really dates to maybe the end of the 19th century. Before then, newspapers were very, it was all very freewheeling and people would just say their piece, you know, in the pages. This notion of like the AP style, the pyramid style, like who, what, why, when, where kind of thing. Like, that's all pretty new in the grand scheme of things. Like, what you saw in newspapers in the 19th century was kind of a whole panoply of different things you would see. People would run poems on the front page, or a sermon, or, you know, a long, like, rambling essay about something. And sometimes they would just have, the kind of ideal of the modern newspaper really took a long time to gel and emerge, really, at the turn of the 20th century, I think, is where we can sort of start to see what looks like what we think of as a newspaper today.
So were men like Ben Franklin the original influencers?
I think you can make that argument. Like, he was certainly very conscious of his own image and his own, and found a way to project himself across platforms, you could say, I guess. Like, he was in the papers, he was publishing pamphlets, he was finding a way to insert himself into all kinds of conversations, and also cultivated this certain image. And this is also something I kind of noted as I was looking at other kind of interesting figures, as you know, over the course of this period of newspaper history. A lot of there were a lot of people, even in an era before photographs or certainly anything like TV or social media, who still made a point of, like, I think Mark Twain had the great phrase of, making oneself conspicuous. that's part of exerting influence. It's not enough just to write a beautiful piece of prose. You've got to, like, create a character around that sometimes. So people like Franklin, later Horace Greeley, Mark Twain, they were known for their appearance and their ability to kind of cause a stir while also being great writers and editors at the same time.
You have a great line in the book that stuck with me. Quote, "The United States, in a very real sense, printed itself into existence." What do you mean?
I think one of the sort of hypotheses that evolved as I was writing the book is, again, coming back to the question of why were Americans so uniquely obsessed with the news and printing and publishing, I think stems from the fact that, unlike other countries, America kind of invented itself out of whole cloth, and compared to, like, any other country at that time or nation at that time, that had emerged through a long period of development where you have certain cultural myths and religious traditions and sort of sense of shared identity. Like, Americans didn't really have that. I mean, yes, they inherited some stuff from England or Holland or wherever. They really didn't have that sense of cohesive shared identity. And I think that was partly the draw of newspapers, was it was a way of asserting, like, this is what it is. This is who we are. These are the beliefs that we share. These are the experiences that we share, and this is how we share them. So there was this kind of effect of, like, stitching the national consciousness together through the pages of these papers that I think really activated some deep-seated need that people had to feel like they were a cohesive, like, culture.
You liken the way material was shared in the early 19th century to a gift economy, much like the early internet. Can you explain how that worked?
Well, yeah, there were a couple of things that happened right at the founding of the country that I think also contributed to this explosive growth of newspapers. One was the Postal Act of 1792, and this sounds a little obscure, but it turned out to be really important. Congress decided very early on that they were going to subsidize the newspaper business because they felt that that access to news was a public good and that people needed to know what was going on in order to be informed citizens and to participate in a democracy. You had to have access to information about what was happening. And so they made a very conscious decision that newspapers would be heavily subsidized. So you could basically mail a newspaper, if you were a printer, for a fraction of what it would cost to mail an equivalent amount of paper that would be like a personal letter or something. They also allowed newspaper printers to send copies of their papers to each other free of charge. And this was actually a really critical decision that they made because it essentially instantly created this network where newspaper printers would just automatically share copies of their papers with each other so that everyone could have access to, it was this kind of gift economy where everyone just recognizes it's a common good for everyone to have access to, this information. So there was no telegraph at the time. There was no Associated Press. It was just kind of understood that it's in everyone's interest for everyone to have access to this. And so then that leads to the second piece of the puzzle, which was the Copyright Act, where newspapers were explicitly excluded from copyright protection. So essentially, they were free to copy anything they wanted with no consequence at all. And that was the case up until the early 1900s. And that because of those two things, newspapers really were able to leverage each other's work and republish each other's work and reproduce it to an astonishing degree. There's a guy named Ryan Cordell, who's a scholar who has done some interesting, actually data mining research with digitized versions of old newspapers. And he's been sort of tracing, he has this project called Viral Texts, where he sort of explores the ways that stories would travel between papers. And it, in a very real sense, some stories would go viral, like something would kind of catch fire and then papers would copy it over and over and over again. But he also estimates that in a typical country newspaper in the early part of the 19th century, about half of what you would see in a newspaper was stuff that was copied from somewhere else. And so it was also like a labor saving thing. Like it was hard for one person to fill the pages of a paper, but if half of the is stuff you can just pull the bench. Some papers actually had what they called scissors editors, whose job it was just to literally cut stories out of other papers, and then they would reset them in type and like put them in their own paper. So it was a very, very different, but in a way kind of echoes what we see today, where there's a lot of resharing and cutting and pasting of things happening today. And that's a lot of what makes the internet work in some ways.
You sort of alluded to something there, which is these early papers, they didn't have to tend to have teams of reporters, right? They were very lean, and basically it was almost like one editor in most of these papers, wasn't it?
For the most part, yeah. I mean, the concept of a reporter as like a job is again, something that really takes shape towards the end of the 19th century. But before then, these were mostly like one man or woman shops. Sometimes it was still often kind of a side hustle, where you would have somebody running a little country print shop, and they part of their business would be their newspaper, and part of it would be doing job printing or, you know, posters or pamphlets or whatever, or, you know, some job for the local government or church or what have you. And then they would run their newspaper as well. Another interesting dimension of this is often they would invite contributors from the community. So you would have people would mail in their poems, or they would send in a little update about, you know, cousin George who came to visit last Sunday, you know, and they had a nice visit. You see these little items that would like get populated in, or people would just, you know, it was a very bottom-up kind of thing, where the, you know, the publisher would sort of be the editor-in-chief, but often there was like a community of people contributing to these papers. And often the way it worked was, it's worth noting though, that in many other cases, there were other parties involved, like especially by the 1820s, 30s, there were also a lot of papers were essentially like became political organs for the local party. And so the contributors would be the local politicians, and the editor was often a very powerful person in the party, and you would have, you know, a paper that would basically be there to support the cause. And that's sort of where they got their funding often.
So I'm reading along about how everyone's copying everybody else. And then all of a sudden into the movie pops Charles Dickens. Talk to us a little bit about his perspective on this free sharing of people's work.
Well, it's interesting. You know, Dickens was himself a former reporter. He actually had been a reporter in London early in his career. And so he was not like, you know, opposed to journalism or anything. But when he came to America on his first visit in, I believe it was 1842, he was originally like greeted as, you know, he was already an incredibly famous writer, and his work had become very popular in America. One of the reasons it became so popular in America is because of the copyright laws. Newspapers were freely republishing his stories all over the place, and he wasn't seeing a dime for it. And once he kind of got to the guy, at first he was, you know, very enamored of America, thought this is great, this is the future of the world, democracy, and yada, yada. But pretty soon thereafter, he started to develop some misgivings about the American press. First, he was peeved about the copyright thing and felt like, you know, he should be getting compensated for his stories that everyone's reading. But he also started to really see the wide range of quality of what was being produced. There were so many papers being produced, and many of them, you know, by this time you were starting to see the early so-called penny press, you know, in places like New York and Boston, these kind of cheaply mass-produced papers that were there, kind of written for the, you know, for a much broader audience, but they were really kind of scandal sheets often, where they were sort of like trying to tear down local politicians or find ways to just boost circulation by printing real often kind of tawdry stuff. And he became kind of horrified. And he actually ended up writing about this in his book, American Notes, which was sort of his journal of his visit. And then later he wrote a novel called Martin Chuzzlewit, where he talks about this. And he kind of like the life and adventures of Martin Chuzzlewit where he really kind of satirizes American newspapers as being these really kind of sleazy, scandal-mongering kind of publications. And the press, in turn, kind of turned on him. Because he was taking the stance about copyright, they kind of started to pillory him as being kind of selfish and, you know, anti-American and what have you. So it didn't end well. He was a little alarmed at what he saw at the sort of extremes of the American press at this time.
So what were the mechanics of printing in the 18th century?
Well, in the 18th century, the process of printing had really surprisingly hardly changed at all since the age of Gutenberg. You know, the Gutenberg press was obviously an incredibly important invention. It involved essentially, you know, taking a corkscrew style mechanism to press ink onto a page that was, you know, an impression pulled from, like, you know, little metal type that you would set into a frame. That process, you know, despite some minor improvements, was really indistinguishable. The print shop that you would see in, you know, the 1750s was almost identical to the one you would have seen in the Gutenberg shop 300 and some years before. That started to change at the beginning of the 19th century, when you started to see the wooden presses started to be replaced by iron presses, which were a little more durable. And then over the course of the century, a lot of things changed. But the thing, and I'm happy to talk more about that, but the one thing that really didn't change until the very end of the century was the process of actually setting type, which was still a very manual process. You know, going back to the beginning of printing, you know, a printer still had to pick out little metal type pieces. They were called sorts, and you had to pull them out, and they would have a case. And this is where the people are familiar with the term uppercase and lowercase. The capital letters were in the upper print case, and the lowercase letters were in the lowercase. And then they would basically set them in a little, you know, in a little tray, and then put them into, arrange them, you know, into what was called a chase that they would then, you know, set in place and press down, you know, using a device called a frisket and a timpan. It's kind of interesting to, like, explore how this stuff actually worked. It was actually a fairly elaborate mechanism, but it worked, but it was very manual and very time consuming. Even though printing underwent a period of industrialization, where you eventually, by mid-century, there were steam powered printing presses, the process of actually moving paper across the, moving paper through a printing process became much faster. The process of setting type remained really stubbornly manual until the very end of the century. It was kind of the last mile that had to be automated. But again, the growth of newspapers in the first part of the century really didn't have that much to do with new technology. That started to change towards the latter half of the century, where a lot of new technologies took shape that did start to accelerate things. But a lot of the early growth was really driven more by progressive government policies, obviously the First Amendment is core to all of this, and just this kind of particular American appetite for news are really the factors that drove the early growth of the press.
You know, we've talked a little bit about the technology, and obviously as things evolve and you start to be able to have paper flow through it, and changes in paper were really important. But let's talk about the life of somebody who's working in one of these print shops, because as I was reading it, it did sound rather Dickensian.
Right. Yeah, it was a tough gig. I mean, working in a print shop was hard work. They used to call the people, you know, the apprentice printers used to be called printers' devils. And I talked about that a little bit at the beginning of the book. The reason they're called that, it's not that they were demonic, but they kind of looked that way. They were often covered in soot and ink. And they were often, like, you know, youngish, you know, people. Usually you apprentice around age 14 or so. And that was sort of your initiation or your trial by fire. You'd be a printer's devil, and you would have to get up at the crack of dawn and come up, and, you know, they were usually doing things like, you know, sweeping the floors and cleaning the ink balls, a process they called treading the pelts. They would take used type and melt it back down to be set into new type in something called the hell box. It was a pretty tough sledding, and they had to work, like, long hours for no pay. They would get sort of room and board. It was a traditional, like, apprentice model. And their life expectancy was shockingly low, like, especially in Europe anyway, for the first few hundred years of printing, printers had a life expectancy that was about half that of a merchant. because they were, think about it, they were breathing basically lead fumes all day, working in the dark, kind of hunched over. They would also have all kinds of, like, you know, orthopedic problems, and many of them turned to drink. Like, you know, there, it was like a heavy drinking culture, and that also often caught up with them. And so there was a lot of, it was a pretty tough business. At the same time, paradoxically, printers enjoyed a pretty high social status as sort of tradespeople went, because of the nature of what they did, they sat very close to the sort of centers of power. Like, the printers were sort of engaging with politicians and religious leaders and people who were putting words to the page. And so on the one hand, you know, they had a kind of tough day-to-day existence, but they also sort of had, in some ways, you know, access to a lot of power. And I think part of the journey for the American printers, and this is where they diverged a bit, I think, from their European counterparts, was they started to, like, really exert that power and sort of claim it for themselves. And I think that's what led to the U.S. having such a powerful press institution as the century went on.
So Mark Twain pops up a number of times in the book. Let's talk about the beginning of his career and the important role of the tramp printer.
Well, yeah, Twain himself started as a printer's devil. He was, I think, 11 or 12 years old when his father died and his family was bankrupt and in debt. And he apprenticed himself to a local printer who was apparently a very harsh taskmaster. He did not have a great experience, but he paid his dues and got through it. And then eventually he took another job. Actually, his brother, his older brother, Orion, had decided to get into the newspaper business and hired young Sam, as he was called at the time, Samuel Clemens, to be his printer's devil. And then, interestingly, Sam started to do something that a lot of people did at the time, which was to write stories anonymously. So he started to actually, on the sly, submit anonymous stories to his brother. And he was pretty sure his brother would not think to run a story by his little brother. And so he got his work accepted by using a pseudonym or several pseudonyms. And then eventually that's how he sort of started his literary career. And so for quite a while, you know, after he'd sort of done a version of an apprenticeship, he decided to do what a lot of people, a lot of young printers did at that time. After you'd done your apprenticeship, you could attain the rank of what was called a journeyman printer. And at that point, what many of them did is they would kind of go on the road and become what's called a tramp printer, which basically means someone who goes from town to town. You could think of them as sort of the original gig worker, where they would go and just pick up work, you know, long enough to pay some bills, you know, buy something to drink, buy something to eat, and then move on to the next town. And it was considered like a very kind of romantic existence. You know, you could basically just, in a very American kind of thing, you can just go from town to town and reinvent yourself over and over again. And so he went on that kind of journey. Eventually he drifted to the East. He went to St. Louis and worked in some of the bigger St. Louis papers. And then he moved to New York, worked there for a while for a few papers, made his way down to Baltimore. I think he was in DC for a while, and then eventually drifted back to the Midwest and worked for his brother again. And so he had this kind of early stint in his career where he was like, this was all before he went on his famous journey to become a riverboat pilot. But for the first part of his career, he was really just training as a printer, first and foremost, doing a little bit of writing on the side, but mostly just learning the craft. And then eventually, years later, he came back to the newspaper world when he and his brother Orion decided to move out to the Nevada territories. And his brother had gotten some kind of government job, I think, with the territorial government. And he was still called Sam at the time. So Sam Clemens decided to first strike out as a miner to try to, everyone was out there trying to get rich in the gold and silver mine. So he staked a claim and tried that. That didn't work. And sort of out of desperation to find a job, he presented himself to the Territorial Enterprise in Virginia City, Nevada, and got hired on and pretty soon started writing papers. And that was where he decided to reinvent himself as Mark Twain. And the Territorial Enterprise was kind of became a legendary newspaper. It was probably the greatest newspaper of the American West, where they had just not just Twain, but some really notably gifted writers who have kind of been forgotten, like Dan DeKeel and others who wrote these really, but like incredibly compelling stories, some of which were you know, there was some hard news in there about what was going on in the silver mines, but they also often just made things up. So they had a lot of tall tales and like crazy stories. So Twain himself wrote one called The Petrified Man. It was like sort of a hoax story about some fossilized person who'd been discovered in the woods. Dan DeKeel wrote one about the traveling stones of Parmalat County or something, about these kind of stones that were mysteriously moving around the desert by themselves. Both of these stories kind of also went viral. They got picked up in other papers. And so scientists would come out to try to, would come out to Nevada to investigate the traveling stones that didn't exist. There was like several attempts to like prove or disprove what was going on there. So, but eventually like Twain, that was kind of where he kind of invented himself as Mark Twain. And then he eventually moved on to San Francisco. He got in trouble. He got in some feuds with a couple of people. There was a lot of feuding going on. It was a very common thing where people, he got challenged to a duel by somebody he had offended in the pages of the Enterprise, and decided to skip town and go to San Francisco, where he started writing for them. And then he went off and went on his journey to become, you know, the Mark Twain, the more famous version of Mark Twain, where he started writing books and things. But that's really where it all started. He came right out of the world of the print shop and was, you know, started his life as a printer's devil. So
Alex, as we mentioned earlier, our favorite chapter is Chapter 7, Hot Blood, Cold Type. Can you please share a couple of the anecdotes about the violence that appeared in 19th century newsrooms?
Sure. I mean, so newspapering was a pretty dangerous business in the 19th century. And, you know, as much as, you know, today we hear about people like getting into flame wars and things, like it was nothing compared to what newspaper people went through often back then. Duels were a common feature of the newspaper trade. And as I mentioned, like Mark Twain left town because he got challenged to a duel, but he was far from the only one to be confronted with the threat of violence. There were many examples, and newspapers were often where duels started. Probably the most famous example would be the Alexander Hamilton Aaron Burr duel, which started with someone getting offended by something printed in a newspaper. But often the duelists were newspaper editors themselves. You would have rival newspapers who would be flinging insults at each other. And the editors would sometimes decide that it wasn't enough to defend their honor in print. They had to like take it to the field of honor. And so the dueling culture was a real thing especially in the first half of the 19th century. It became especially prevalent in the South. Like actually after the Burr-Hamilton duel, it was kind of like increasingly frowned on in the North, but in the South, they still had this very like traditional kind of European kind of mindset, this kind of chivalric code that somehow translated into this honor culture, where if your honor had been assaulted, then it was incumbent on you to defend your honor with a pistol. And it was a very common thing that sort of these hot-blooded editors would get into these beefs with each other and end up shooting at each other. Probably the most extreme example of that was in Vicksburg, Mississippi, the Vicksburg Sentinel. In a space of about, I think, 12 or 15 years, they went through 8 different editors, and like 6 of them were shot on the job because they had offended somebody. It was kind of amazing. Like they were just dropping like flies, and it was just but that was just maybe an extreme example of phenomena that happened all the time in Richmond. There was an editor named John Daniel of the Richmond Examiner, who was also pretty hot-blooded and kind of spicy. And he would, he often got into trouble sort of criticizing the authorities, and he would go after Robert E. Lee or whoever, and would often, find himself on the receiving end of a threat. I'm going to pause for a second, make sure I get this story right. So Daniel is an interesting literary footnote in that he famously got into a beef with Edgar Allan Poe, who was at the time living in Richmond. And Poe had taken offense to something that Daniel had written about him in the paper, to do with one of his lady friends, I believe. It kind of implied that he was having an affair with a widow named Sarah Whitman. And Poe was so outraged that he immediately challenged Daniel to a duel. He marched into the office of the Richmond Examiner, but unfortunately Poe was too drunk to really stand his ground. And so they decided they couldn't quite pull off the duel. Instead, they all went out for a drink, and who ended up reading some of his poetry at a tavern, and they actually became lifelong friends after that. So, duel with a happy ending, I guess. All duels should end that way.
Absolutely.
Okay, so let's move into the later part of the 19th century. How did the Civil War change the way news was transmitted across the country? We've talked about how things were mailed, but all of a sudden we got wires, don't we?
Yeah, the Civil War was really, I think, a pivotal moment in all of American history, needless to say, but particularly for newspapers. You know, a couple of important things happened during the war. One, the telegraph, which had been invented, you know, in the 1840s, but it had not actually been heavily used, certainly for news delivery before then. It was used in kind of fits and starts. It was a little expensive, and newspapers hadn't really had cause to like embrace it. But the war changed that because, you know, percentage of the population was involved in the war in one way or the other, and that naturally created a lot of demand and interest in what was going on the battlefields. And the telegraph turned out to be the perfect vehicle for people to start getting much more regular updates about what was going on. So it fueled a heavy demand for up to the minute news. I mean, up to the week news about what had been going on recently. But the telegraph also, because it became such a predominant vehicle for news from the battlefields to be sent across the country, it also changed the form of journalism itself. Because, you know, it costs money to transmit news by the wires, it led to this much more economical style of writing, where reporters really were under pressure to deliver the maximum, you know, ratio of facts to words that they could possibly come up with. And so it really directly led to this very, Spartan kind of like just the fact style of reporting that eventually came to dominate in the 20th century for sort of hard news reporting. This was also where the Associated Press started to really gather steam and coalesce. It had also sort of existed a little bit before then, but it started to really, become this kind of infrastructure. And so I think between the Telegraph, the AP, also worth noting that, you know, there was another important invention that I don't talk about as much in the book, but it's in there, is really about the advances in lithography and steel plate printing, where people could now produce images much more quickly. Like, there weren't a lot of, like, images were pretty expensive to produce and had traditionally been sort of hand cut from wood, but now there were these new stereotyping and engraving methods where you could get these quick, even though photography wasn't quite there yet, you know, for purposes of news reporting. They had a lot of papers would send out these sketch artists who would do these quick sketches from the battlefield that could then be reproduced very quickly, not over the telegraph, but still distributed on plates that could then be spread. So you started to see this kind of visual journalism starting to take shape. Harper's Weekly and some other notable papers started to take shape during this period that were much more illustrative in their approach. And that was also, I think, a big change that, you know, started to evolve. So the combination of more photorealistic kind of illustrations and this kind of more pyramid style journalism really kind of stemmed from the changes during the Civil War in a lot of ways.
So I know there are a lot of photos of aftermath of Civil War battles. So they weren't taking the photos to go into the newspapers. I didn't know that.
Well, there were photos for sure, but if you look at the papers that were popular, one was called Frank Leslie's Illustrated Paper and Harper's Weekly. They're mostly like very photorealistic kind of black and white pencil drawings that were done. Later there were, you know, photography was still like in its infancy at this time. So it was much, I think, probably more cost effective to like send a sketch artist out there, but certainly photography was starting to become a thing, but I don't know that they were being reproduced in newspapers all that regularly at that time.
You mentioned earlier the importance of mechanical typesetting. Let's talk about why it was so important. And also, how does Mark Twain pop up again in this story?
Yes. Yeah, so as I mentioned earlier, the kind of last mile of the process, the setting of type, turned out to be a really hard problem to solve. There were people trying to solve that problem throughout the 19th century. There were any number of inventors who were trying to find the mechanism that would let you sort of automate the setting of type with a machine. But it turns out to be, you know, a difficult engineering challenge. A big reason for that is, you know, if you look at the way you know, newspapers are composed in columns, there's the problem of justification, where, you know, the left side and the right side of the column sort of typically line up. And so that involves a lot of subtle spacing. You have to insert spacers and get that just right. Not to mention, you know, just the problem of, you know, just developing a mechanism to, like, to transfer the type in a way that's going to be stable and sort of correctable as well is also part of the problem, because people, you know, make mistakes. But it was really the justification was kind of the hardest part of the problem. And so a lot of people saw the opportunity there, and it was kind of widely recognized that this was a problem that needed to be solved. And especially with the growing, the growth of daily newspapers and sort of big urban centers, because there were now these, you were starting to see some economies of scale where the biggest papers like the New York Herald or the Tribune might have a million plus circulation, and they'd have like kind of a small army of typesetters sitting in their print shops, like setting the pages every day. Everyone kind of knew something had to give. There were even like professional typesetting races where the very fastest typesetters would compete for prize money. And it was a spectator sport, believe it or not, back then. But anyway, in the 1880s, Twain makes contact with a guy named James W. Page, who's an inventor who has claims to have solved this problem. And he has an invention that he's working on called the Page Compositor that will allow you to set type automatically using a kind of keyboard mechanism. And Twain becomes enamored of this idea, decides this is the future. By this point, Twain has had a lot of success. You know, his big books have come out, Huckleberry Finn and Tom Sawyer and, you know, all, Innocents Abroad, and a lot of he's made his fortune. He also had the good fortune to marry a well-to-do family. So even though he himself came from poverty, he'd done well for himself, and he had become a bit of an investor. He had started investing in things like typewriters and all kinds of little, he was always making these little bets. He was almost like a kind of angel investor. He was obsessed with new technologies. He was always trying to place a little bet here or there. And he was convinced that he had kind of a Midas touch at that point, because everything he did was coming up roses. Like, he had also started his own publishing company and had, recently published Ulysses S. Grant's memoirs, mm-hmm. which was a massive bestseller. And so he felt like he could do no wrong. And so he ended up plowing his fortune into this device that he was convinced was going to change the world. And it didn't. Unfortunately, it's kind of a tragic story. Page was, you know, a brilliant inventor, but also a little bit of a snake oil salesman, mm-hmm. who was kind of, you know, ended up getting very excited about a project where there were certainly like an idea that had potential there. But Page was a bit of a perfectionist who just couldn't let go and wanted it to be just so good and so precise that it could really do anything that a human typesetter could do. And Twain himself, having been a typesetter, also kind of bought into that vision. But what they ended up producing was, I think you could argue, sort of an over-engineered machine that was prone to break down. And it was always delayed, perpetually. You know, there was always like one more thing they were trying to fix. Twain ended up getting very frustrated with Page, but he had thrown so much money into this that he kept kind of throwing good money after bad. And in the meantime, a competing invention was taking shape. A guy named Ottmar Mergenthaler, a German watchmaker, actually, who had emigrated to the United States, had been working on a similar idea for a product that came to be called the Linotype. And it did the same thing, but faster and cheaper and more reliably. And so Twain and Page basically saw the opportunity evaporate out from under them when Mergenthaler came along, and he was soon, the New York Tribune ended up investing, and popularizing his machine. And you could argue that the page compositor was a more elegant solution in a lot of ways, but the line of type machine just worked. And it's often the case in the history of technology that, like, the quote, best technology does not always win. It's the one that gets the job done quicker and faster and cheaper is often the one that wins.
The 19th century version of VHS versus Betamax.
That's a perfect corollary. Yeah.
All right. So go ahead.
No, go ahead. That's
fine. So we're getting to the end of the 19th century. Let's talk about we talked at the beginning about what it looked like at the end of the 18th century. How had it transformed by the end of the 19th century? And talk a little bit more about how we now have large capitalist, well-capitalized publishers.
So by the end of the 19th century, the whole publishing economy had really undergone a dramatic transformation. You know, from the first part of the century, where newspaper printing was really kind of a mom and pop kind of proposition. You had these small little print shops scattered all over the country where people were just kind of hand rolling their own little papers and doing the best they could. By the end of the century, newspapers had really turned into a powerful industry. They had achieved a certain economy of scale and political and cultural influence with big circulation. And I'm talking about sort of the big urban papers here. There were still many country papers, to be clear, but the sort of center of gravity had shifted towards these big papers in the big cities like San Francisco and Chicago and New York and Boston and so on. And as a result, you know, you started to see the emergence of this new kind of class of worker. So whereas previously, you know, the newspaper might have been produced by what was sometimes called the able editor, who was someone who could do all the jobs. They could set the type and sell the ads and sell the circulation and write stories and edit and do, it was, you know, they did all the things. As, you know, newspapers became more industrialized, inevitably roles become specialized. And so you start to see the emergence of professional printers. So the trade of printing becomes like a kind of unionized job, and people, that's just the whole job is typesetting or printing. And similarly, reporting becomes a job. And so you start to see this kind of new class of sort of urban professionals who are full-time reporters and editors. And that's kind of a newish thing, but that becomes like the template for the eventual, like, you know, emergence of the mass media around this time, where you have these big organizations that are, you know, increasingly commercial, like they are driven by ads, predominantly by advertising, which was also something that hadn't really been the case so much before. They have a ton of political clout. They are designed for a mass audience. They're producing a product that's meant to be consumed by the masses. And so that's really the change from like papers that were really geared around specific communities, you know, that were much more, had this kind of organic relationship with their readers and subscribers and local businesses, to this more kind of industrialized economy of scale where you're producing for the mass. And unfortunately, the result of that, a lot of those sort of voices that were so varied in the early newspaper landscape start to get squeezed out. You know, I talk a little bit in the beginning of the earlier chapters about like how newspapers allowed for a lot of different voices to emerge. You started to see, you know, women's newspapers and newspapers from marginalized communities, you know, Native American newspapers and abolitionist newspapers, you know, Black-owned newspapers. All this stuff starts to sort of give way over time to a much, much more of what we think what today is sort of disparagingly called the mainstream media. But to be clear, I don't want to imply that I'm somehow think that what came before was altogether better. Like what did emerge with the big news organizations was this more professional code of ethics, where people started to start journalism schools and started to outline what professional journalism looks like. The idea that these organizations should hold themselves accountable for getting things right. They should issue corrections. They should at least aspire towards some kind of neutral point of view on things. Of course, not always, you know, doing that well, but at least there was sort of an ideal of what, you know, professional reporting should be. And this sort of emergence of the divide between what's often called in newspapers the church and state. So the editorial side and the business side emerges during this period, which I think you can argue is a good thing in terms of ensuring the sort of reliability and credibility of the editorial coverage. So I don't want to be too black and white about this, so to speak, but things definitely changed pretty dramatically, you know, as we get to the end of the 19th century. So
the book is Empire of Ink: The Printers, Rogues, and Radicals Who Invented the American Newspaper. Alex Wright, thanks for spending so much time with us this morning.
Yeah, I really enjoyed this conversation. It was great talking to you.
Please subscribe to the Mountain Money podcast to stay on top of all the latest episodes of KPCW's Mountain Money.
If you have any ideas for Mountain Money, please shoot us an email at mountainmoney@kpcw.org.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoy the show, make sure you leave a review no matter how you listen. And we'd appreciate it if you clicked 5 stars.